picture the year 1730. You are in London. And I don't mean the polished aristocratic London of those nice period dramas you see on TV.
No ball gowns here.
Definitely not. You are in a cramped, completely smog-choked village just outside the city proper, and it is bleak. I mean, the sky is just this permanent, bruised gray, and the streets smell heavily of coal smoke and, well, open sewers.
Yeah, a really tough place to exist.
Exactly. Cool. But the absolute worst part of the scenario is that the lottery of birth has gone terribly, terribly against you. You're born at the absolute bottom of this rigidly immovable English class system. Like, your father isn't a duke or an earl or some wealthy merchant. He is a street sweeper or maybe a day laborer.
Which means you are too.
Right. And in that specific world, your destiny is permanently sealed before you even take your first breath. Biology is destiny.
Yeah, the gravity of that 18th century class system was just absolute. There were no missing rungs on the social ladder. The ladder itself simply did not exist for the vast majority of the population. You know, if you were born at the bottom, you would stay at the bottom.
Yeah.
And so would your children and their children. It was a suffocating, just entirely closed loop.
And that feeling of being totally trapped, that is the exact headspace we need you to be in for this deep dive today. Because when we typically talk about the American Revolution, we have this habit of, you know, envisioning it as this highly sterile philosophical event.
Very polished. Very textbook.
Exactly. We picture wealthy, highly educated men in powdered wigs standing in these grand halls in Philadelphia, politely debating the finer points of Enlightenment philosophy and taxation. It's the classic textbook version. But our mission today is to completely strip away that traditional view.
Which we really need to do.
Yeah, we are going to examine the revolution not as an abstract debate, but as a gritty, desperate machine for social climbing.
It is a much more accurate lens, honestly. It wasn't merely a war for independence from some distant king. It was a violent disruption of that old world class system you just described.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to really get into the weeds of how this machine worked, we are grounding our deep dive in a fascinating and honestly slightly unusual set of documents. We're looking at a compilation called My Patriot Story, Volumes 1 and 2.
Yeah, these are amazing sources.
They really are. They're these incredibly detailed genealogical records, painstakingly put together by the Blue Ridge chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution, or the DAR.
And the reason these specific DAR records are so vital is that they provide us with a genuine bottom-up history.
Right, not the big names.
Exactly. We aren't looking at the highly curated, politically sanitized biographies of the founding fathers. These compilations are built from the ground up. I mean, they're extracted from faded ink in literal family Bibles, from crumbling, handwritten local court records that somehow survived courthouse fires, and from front porch oral traditions passed down through generations.
That is so cool.
It is. And they highlight the marginalized outcasts. We're talking about the convicts, the desperately poor immigrants, and the religious refugees who essentially utilized the absolute chaos of a continental war to invent a completely new life.
Which means we really have to start with the darkest origins of the colonies. We have to dispel that collective cultural memory, you know, the Thanksgiving myth, where early colonists were all pious pilgrims seeking religious freedom, stepping off the Mayflower in their little buckled hats.
Right. That's just not the reality for most people.
The brutal reality is that many early arrivals were treated as literal human cargo.
Yeah. Take Margaret Lawrence, for example. Though the records note everyone just called her Peggy. So in 1730, she stood trial at the Old Bailey Courthouse in London, and she was sentenced to death.
Wait, I need to pause here, because her crime is incredibly jarring. I mean, she wasn't convicted of murder or high treason against the crown. She simply helped an older woman rob an employer of a few basic household goods.
Yeah, some very minor items.
And for that, she was going to be publicly hanged. I mean, how does that legal system even function?
Well, you have to look at the mechanics of what historians call the Bloody Code. London in 1730 had a booming population, but absolutely zero professional police force.
Oh, wow.
None at all.
None.
Because the state had no organized way to reliably catch criminals, they relied entirely on extreme psychological terror.
That is dark.
It is. The penalty for stealing something as minor as a silver spoon just had to be death, simply to terrify the next desperate person out of trying it. The system valued the property of the wealthy far more than the lives of the poor.
Fortunately for Peggy, her death sentence was commuted, but she wasn't set free. She was sentenced to transportation.
Which was very common.
Right. So she arrived in Maryland not as a free immigrant looking for opportunity, but as an indentured servant. She was legally bound human property for a set term of years.
And things get really complicated for her there.
They do. She is essentially sold to a man named Tobias Phillips. She becomes his mistress, has two sons by him, one of who is Thomas. And then tragically, Peggy dies in 1739 when Thomas is only 6 years old.
Which is an incredible tragedy for a young child. Mm-hmm. But the 18th century legal nightmare that immediately follows is what's truly staggering.
Yeah, this part is wild.
Because she was an indentured servant, Peggy had not yet paid off her labor debt to her master. And in that era, a mother's legal status completely defined her children's status. Her labor debt didn't just vanish into the ether when she passed away. The law dictated that it transferred directly to her next of kin.
Which is?
It transferred to a 6-year-old boy.
Think about the mechanics of this. Imagine the last time you felt trapped by debt.
Mm-hmm.
Now compare Thomas's situation to inheriting a massive underwater mortgage from your parents. But instead of owing hundreds of thousands of dollars on a house that you can't sell, the debt is tied to your own physical body.
Your physical freedom is the collateral. And to make the psychological dynamic even more twisted, when Tobias, who is the owner and the biological father, dies shortly after, his estate passes to his legitimate son, George. So Thomas legally becomes a bondservant to his own legitimate half-brother.
I mean, you are living in the exact same house as your half-brother, watching him inherit the land, the wealth, the respect, while you inherit a literal chain of servitude. It is that exact suffocating London hierarchy playing out under a single roof in Maryland.
But, you know, Thomas doesn't let it break him. He endures the grueling physical labor. He works off that indenture day in and day out, year after year. And eventually, when the estate is settled, he receives his freedom dues.
Which was what, exactly?
It was a customary transition fee, basically meant to keep freed servants from immediately starving on the street.
Yeah.
Thomas received 500 pounds of tobacco.
Now, when a modern listener hears 500 pounds of tobacco, they probably just picture a massive lifelong smoking habit. But tobacco wasn't just a cash crop or a bad habit. It was green gold.
Yeah, it was literal currency in Virginia and Maryland. Oh, yeah. You could use it to pay your local taxes, to buy imported goods from overseas, to trade for livestock. That green gold was the critical seed capital Thomas needed. He took that tobacco, leveraged it, and actually managed to buy land of his own in Virginia.
Wow.
He pulls off this incredible paradox, going from a legally bound servant, the son of a deported convict, to a landed property owner in a single lifetime.
But that brings me to a huge point of pushback, something I really struggle to understand when reading this timeline.
Okay, what is it?
By January 1777, the Revolutionary War is in full swing. Thomas is in his mid-40s. He is a comfortable landowner. He has a family. He's settled. He has completely escaped the gravity of the British class system. Why on earth would he risk it all to enlist in the 10th Virginia Regiment?
That's a fair question.
I mean, he fights at Brandywine, at Germantown, at Monmouth. These were absolute bloodbaths where survival was a coin toss. Why risk the very thing he spent 4 decades trying to earn?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it makes perfect sense. Thomas didn't fight because he was inspired by abstract philosophy.
He wasn't reading John Locke.
No, he wasn't sitting in his parlor reading John Locke's treatises on government. He fought because he had immense skin in the game.
Yeah.
He had climbed so far against impossible odds, and he was fighting to cement that hard-won status.
Ah, I see.
He knew exactly what the British system looked like because he grew up in the shadow of it. He knew that if the crown won the war and reasserted full control, a man with convict blood who bought his way up would simply be pushed right back down to the bottom.
So Thomas Lawrence paid his dues in blood to protect a status he had already earned. But if we look slightly westward, we see families who were fighting just to afford the price of admission in the first place. I'm talking about the buffer people.
Yes, the buffer people.
Mm-hmm.
These were the economic migrants who fled crushing poverty in places like Scotland or Ireland, who arrived completely penniless and were immediately pushed to the brutal western edges of the colonial frontier.
But how exactly were they pushed there? Like, did the government literally march them west?
No, it was a calculated economic mechanism. The wealthy coastal elites completely controlled the safe, established land grants in the East. If you arrived with nothing, the only dirt you could legally afford or be granted was out on the dangerous western edge.
So it was by design?
Entirely. The elites intentionally populated the frontier with these desperately poor immigrants to act as a geographic meat shield, basically absorbing indigenous attacks so the wealthy folks on the coast could sleep soundly.
That is so cynical. And the DAR records introduce us to a man who lived this reality, Alexander Berkeley, who fled poverty in Dundee, Scotland at age 15.
He's a fascinating case.
He is, but I have to stop right here and issue a massive challenge to the validity of these specific DIR records.
Yeah.
The claims in the Berkeley file are highly, highly improbable.
They are definitely extreme.
They claim Alexander lived to be 114 years old, dying in 1825. They claim his wife, Amy, lived to be 111, a 90-year marriage on the disease-ridden, hostile 18th century frontier.
Yeah, the math is rough there.
And then there is this piece of absolute folklore. It says, Alexander went blind at age of 109, miraculously regained his sight for exactly 30 days, just so he could read his Bible one last time, and then went completely blind again. Come on. These are fish stories.
Your skepticism is entirely justified, and, you know, it is a vital part of historical analysis. We always have to acknowledge that over generations, family lore naturally morphs into these superhero origin stories.
Right, the fish gets bigger every time you tell the story.
Exactly. However, if we synthesize this and shave even two or three decades off his age, the historical truth anchoring the story remains undeniable.
Okay, fair enough.
Even in his late 60s or 70s, Alexander was an old man when the revolution began. He was too old to march, but he actively funded the rebels by paying heavy supply taxes. And more importantly, the hard military records prove his three sons, Alexander Jr., George, and James, all served in the Virginia line.
Just to clarify for anyone who doesn't spend their weekends reading military history, the Virginia line wasn't just a ragtag local militia, right?
Correct. The Virginia line was part of the regular Continental Army. This meant mandated multi-year enlistments, marching far from home, and enduring the absolute worst conditions of the war.
Well, let me play devil's advocate here. We're talking about incredibly poor frontier families in the middle of a chaotic war. Is it possible they were just opportunistic mercenaries?
I mean,
we know the Tories, the British loyalists, were fleeing and leaving property behind. Were these frontier boys just using the chaos of the revolution to steal abandoned Tory land or grab whatever wealth they could?
It is a cynical question, but a necessary one. However, the military records definitively disprove the mercenary theory.
Really? How so?
Because the sons served their mandated brutal terms in the Continental Army. They survived the freezing conditions, the starvation, and the disease. They were officially discharged, free and clear, and they went home.
Okay.
What's fascinating here is that after all of that, they voluntarily returned to Williamsburg to reenlist. Yeah, mercenaries do not walk back into a starving camp when their contract is up. They weren't mercenaries. They were quite literally buying stock in a new country. They were making an investment.
But the cost of that investment was devastating. James died of disease in the army camp. Alexander Jr. was killed in combat. You have these ancient parents, Alexander and Amy, spending their final decades mourning the literal flesh and blood price of admission they paid.
That's incredibly tragic.
They traded their children's lives to guarantee that their one surviving son, George, and all of his descendants would never be subject to a king again.
Yeah, they paid the ultimate price for a future they would never personally get to enjoy.
Those families shed literal blood on the front lines to buy their ticket in. But, you know, a ticket doesn't mean much if the entire enterprise starves to death before the war is won.
That is very true.
Not everyone fought on the front lines. Some risked absolutely everything to provide the invisible backbone of the war effort and to plant permanent roots. Let's look at George Peter Hillegas.
He was a religious refugee who fled severe Catholic persecution in Germany and sought refuge in Pennsylvania. And his name, Hillegas, ironically translates to grassy battlefield.
That's fitting.
It is. But his real battlefield wasn't a grassy field at all. It was a grist mill.
Amateurs talk tactics. Professionals talk logistics. The Continental Army was notoriously underfunded and constantly on the brink of starvation. Hillegas funded the resistance with calories. He was supplying the flour that kept George Washington's army alive.
And the scale of what he was doing cannot be overstated.
Yeah.
He wasn't just baking a few extra loaves of bread in his kitchen.
Consider the modern equivalent. It would be like trying to run a massive clandestine Amazon distribution center right under the nose of a hostile military occupation.
That's a great way to put it.
We are talking about massive, heavy sacks of grain, creaky wooden carts constantly moving in and out, and a giant, noisy mill that is physically impossible to hide. The daily terror of high treason must have been overwhelming.
Oh, absolutely.
He was risking loyalist neighbors turning him in for a reward. He was constantly risking a British cavalry patrol, riding up, burning his entire livelihood to the ground, and hanging him and his family from the nearest tree.
He put everything on the line to feed the army that was protecting his sanctuary. And it raises an important question about how these religious refugees actually defined safety and permanence.
Yeah, and if we look at another record, the last will and testament of Peter Lefebvre, we see exactly what they valued.
We really do.
But before we get to his will, Lefebvre was a Huguenot in Lancaster County. For our listeners who might just recognize that word from European history class, what did being a Huguenot actually mean for his family's safety?
Well, the Huguenots were French Protestants in a fiercely Catholic France. They weren't just disliked. They were heavily persecuted, stripped of their rights, and actively hunted by the state.
So it was life or death.
Completely. Fleeing across the ocean was a matter of basic survival.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because Livres will strip away all the societal fluff and show you exactly what mattered to a person at the end of their life. Lefebvre leaves his wife 550 pounds, a sturdy stone dwelling, specific amounts of grain and meat, and very specifically listed in the legal document, 5 apple trees.
And that detail about the apple trees is incredibly profound when you understand the agricultural mechanics behind it.
Okay, tell me about the mechanics.
You don't just toss an apple seed into the dirt and get a perfect piece of fruit a few months later. Growing apples requires grafting branches, meticulous pruning, and waiting sometimes 5 to 10 years before the tree bears a single usable apple.
Wow, so it's a huge time investment.
Exactly. Committing to an apple orchard means committing a decade of your life to a single patch of dirt. For a refugee who fled across an ocean with nothing, running for his life, to plant trees that take years to mature, that is the ultimate symbol of long-term generational planning.
It's undeniable proof that sanctuary had officially taken root in the ground.
It really is.
We've pivoted from those who built their sanctuary quietly to those who defended it. But some defended it with sheer kinetic violence, fueled entirely by the trauma of their past. We have to talk about Ebenezer Fane.
Yes, Ebenezer Fane.
He was another Huguenot descendant who enlisted in the military at just 14 years old in the brutal Southern theater of the war.
And we have to clarify what the Southern theater actually looked like. This wasn't two neat lines of brightly dressed men firing synchronized volleys across a polite open field.
Right. No gentleman's warfare here.
Not at all. The war in the South was essentially an intimate neighbor-on-neighbor bloodbath in the deep woods and swamps. It was guerrilla warfare, where traditional European military rules were completely thrown out the window.
The records show Fane shot a spy point blank while on guard duty and was severely wounded at the incredibly chaotic Battle of Kings Mountain. Compare that to a modern 14-year-old.
It's hard to even imagine.
You have an 8th grader with a backpack complaining about algebra homework versus a child fielding a heavy musket and hand-to-hand woodland combat. Where does a 14-year-old even find that kind of ferocity?
Well, it connects directly back to his Huguenot background.
Yeah.
Fane didn't just hear passive bedtime stories about religious persecution. His family carried the deep generational institutional memory of being hunted, tortured, and slaughtered simply for how they prayed.
That leaves a mark.
A massive one. That deep ancestral trauma resulted in an absolute zero-tolerance policy. When they saw a distant king trying to impose his will, levy taxes without representation, and strip away their newly found rights, they recognized the early warning signs of tyranny.
They'd seen this movie before.
Exactly. And they fought with absolute ferocity to prevent it from taking hold again.
Bringing all these incredible threads together, we have Thomas Lawrence, the convict's son, carrying his mother's physical legal chains. We have the Berkeleys, the grieving Scottish migrants paying the blood price on the frontier. We have Hillegas running the massive secret mill under threat of the noose, and Fane, the teenage soldier, fueled by ancestral trauma.
It's an intense lineup.
It is. These are not the wealthy, highly educated elites we see painted on our currency.
Not at all. We are looking at a desperate, gritty transaction for upward mobility, signed in blood by marginalized outcasts.
So what does this all mean? I think it completely dismantles the classic melting pot metaphor we always hear in history class.
I agree completely.
The melting pot implies this gentle, passive blending of ingredients over time, like a slow cooker soup simmering on a Sunday afternoon where everyone just happily melts together.
But the DAR records reveal that it wasn't a gentle melting. It was a violent forging.
A violent forging.
Yes. It required the searing, unimaginable heat of a brutal war and the immense, crushing pressure of pure survival to hammer these disparate, desperate outcasts into a single unified identity.
It's a completely different way to view the founding of a nation.
It is. And it brings up a really provocative thought to consider today.
What's that?
Well, in the 18th century, these outcasts, the convicts, the debtors, the refugees, pulled off this gritty transaction for a clean slate because of the chaos of their environment.
Right.
They relied on missing court records, the vast unbridgeable distance from the old world, and the sheer untracked wilderness to literally reinvent themselves.
Mm.
But look at the world you live in today.
Yeah, you can't exactly disappear into the woods anymore.
Exactly. We exist in a hyper-connected modern panopticon. Every financial debt, every minor legal record, every misstep is permanently tracked, stored, and instantly searchable in global databases.
You can't just move one town over and invent a new name anymore. The wilderness is fully mapped and the court records never burn.
They never burn.
Which leaves us with a heavy question to explore on your own. In a world that never forgets and never loses a record, can today's outcasts ever truly get a clean slate? Or are we slowly returning to a world where, once again, your starting point dictates your destiny?